둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
Got what? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See the Podcast, Season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to Going There, the crossroads where music and mental health meet. Today we are talking with singer-songwriter Amy Mann. Now, many of us know Amy as one of the founding members of the new wave band Till Tuesday with their epic hit Voices Carry. Amy has then gone on to a fantastic solo career, including writing and performing songs for movies such as Magnolia and I Am Sam, and having her songs used in shows such as Ted Lasso and I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Over the course of her career, she's won 2 Grammy Awards with an additional 6 nominations. Amy's 2017 album, Mental Illness, was called her quintessential statement, a wake-up call delivered as a lullaby. Amy's got a new album coming out on her own label, Super Ego Records, called Queens of the Summer Hotel, which includes the song Suicide is Murder. So check those out at amymann.com. Now, on the Going There podcast, we have the tough conversations to address important issues so that we can learn from each other, challenge the stigma of mental illness, and get the care we need. And during our conversation, Amy talks about her own struggle with depression and anxiety. One of the things that Amy talks about is how she experiences her depression as actually holding down her anxiety like a lid. She explained how her obsessive thoughts can be so powerful and overwhelming that her depression was almost a response to keep the intensity of her thoughts in check. In addition, Amy talks about how, just as mental illness is devastating when we experience it ourselves, it is also devastating when someone close to us struggles with their mental health. Amy shares how her song Suicide is Murder is for a planned stage musical based on the book Girl Interrupted. And the song is about how many people experience the suicide of a loved one as a murder because their loved one was tragically taken away from them. And the contrast is so striking between how we feel about ourselves when we are depressed, that we are disconnected, isolated, and alone, with how much the people around us would suffer if we were gone. So it is very valuable when we're able to talk about the issue of mental illness from multiple perspectives. It helps us all have a bit more understanding of and empathy for what everyone involved is going through. Now, as we progress through this season of Going There, our goal is to bring you, the audience, further into the conversation. On the Consequence website and wherever you find these episodes, you'll find a short questionnaire. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions that you have that have been sparked by our conversations with these incredible artists, and topics you'd love to see addressed. We incorporate these responses into episodes, as well as a monthly column called Ask Dr. Mike on the Consequence website. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. These help other folks find their way into the conversation so that they can go there with us. So let's go there and listen to what Amy has to say. Okay, Amy, welcome to Going There.
Thank you.
So
you have ostensibly done many different songs and albums that have to do with mental health. And I thought that what we would start with is 2017, which was titled Mental Illness. And the reviews and press that I've seen on it says that it discussed issues of depression, self-harm, suicide. And so I thought we would start there and just, you know, getting some of your thoughts on what was happening with that album and your experiences with those issues.
Well, the title was a little bit tongue in cheek, and it sort of came from, I was talking to a friend of mine when I had, you know, was finishing up the record, and he said, you know, what are these new songs, you know, what are they about? And I said, oh, you know, my usual songs about mental illness. And he said, you should call the record Mental Illness. So it's, you know, it's a little jocular, but it's also not, you know, it's not inaccurate. I think I'd have to sort of see a track listing to go song by song to, you know, tell you what exactly was, you know, what was in there and what was going on. But, you know, there were definitely a few songs that were inspired by somebody I knew who was bipolar and also probably like possibly a sociopath, and that was a very strange experience. So I definitely ended up writing some songs that kind of touched on that personality.
I think that one of the things that's very tough with mental illness of any kind is not just that it impacts the person who's struggling with it, but the people around them. And obviously the person who's struggling is the one who needs the most immediate care, but oftentimes family, friends, coworkers, the stress of being connected with someone who's struggling, it kind of goes unchecked and unnoticed, quite frankly, but it can be incredibly stressful and overwhelming at times.
Yeah. And even in a casual relationship, you know, you just don't know how to deal with it. There was another friend of mine who would periodically call me, and you know, I'm not sure what his diagnosis is. I feel like he was bipolar, but with, you know, where there starts to become like a psychotic element, like a hallucinatory element. And it's just, I don't know how to handle this. Even taking a phone call and, you know, and still listening to people talk, you know, you don't know what to say. You're afraid that you're going to make it worse. You know, because their reality is, you know, built on sand. Your reality with them is also built on sand.
And one of the things that can happen that's so difficult is that oftentimes when people struggle with a mental health issue, you know, people dismiss, they'll use terms like crazy or irrational or distorted, which are terms that I don't particularly like, not just because I don't think they're true, they're pejorative, but one of the things that does happen often is that people, when they're struggling, are actually incredibly sensitive to and aware of what's happening around them. So they can tell when, maybe through no fault of their own, but something that's happening with their mental health is causing someone close to them to be uncomfortable or to be stressed out. And that cycle then, it's like you almost feel yourself in the moment being like, oh my God, I'm talking too fast, and I can see that they're freaking out a little bit and they're getting stressed. And then that cycle really just kind of helps, unfortunately, someone devolve even further.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And as the person on the other side, it's very hard to know exactly, you know, what to say and how to say it. You know, your mind goes immediately to how can I stop this from happening? And, you know, but know who's equipped for that.
Yeah. And that, that concept of how can I stop this from happening? Because what winds up happening is the person who's experiencing, whether it's depression or a manic episode, whatever it might be, doesn't want to be experiencing those feelings, whether it's feeling so depressed that they can't move or manic to the point where they feel out of control. And so they try to suppress it. The person, like you're saying, kind of like, well, I want to stop this because that's the natural reaction. That feels like the helpful reaction. And then it almost becomes this little bit of a game of chicken of sorts, because it's like, if you can stop it, it would be so great. But then if you can't stop it, but you're trying to stop it, it actually winds up making it worse for either the person or themselves.
I think with depression, which, you know, like I haven't really experienced you know, mania, but I've definitely experienced depression. You know, you can tell when, and I've obviously been on the other side of this too, where the other person just wants it to be, they just don't want to deal with it, or they do, you know, they don't know how to deal with it, or they don't want to deal with it. And then, you know, you get a lot of advice and you don't want advice, you know, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to hear about, you know, how you should snap out of it or cheer up, or, you know, how studies have shown that exercise is more efficacious than medication. You know, like, you just don't want to hear that stuff, you know, especially because it doesn't feel true. You know, you're like, well, I've tried to exercise and that didn't work, so it doesn't feel true. And just the sort of it amplifies the problem when you know somebody just wants to make it go away because they don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, that concept of it not feeling true, you know, because when we're depressed, one of the things that happens is that our bodies and our minds are naturally more predisposed, for lack of a better way of saying it, to gather information that justifies the mood. You know, from an evolutionary perspective, like we're kind of organized a little bit around our mood. And it's like, oh, like, let's bring up everything that you've ever thought or smelled or tasted or seen or heard that is associated with depression. And, you know, so that's something that's very hard for people when either they're not depressed or they're not in a depressive episode to realize that, yeah, you're saying it, but I don't feel this at all. What you're saying, you may think you're trying to help, but it's...
Yeah, there's a disconnect between what you're feeling and what other people are saying. And the disconnect, you know, just opens that gap even further between the two of you, you know. And then, you know, I think depression is very isolating, so then you're, you know, feel even more isolated.
Yeah, and I think the isolation happens in a few ways. You know, number one, you're isolated from that feeling that you used to have, that mojo, those that self-connection that you had. You know, things that used to feel good don't feel good. So you're like isolated from yourself. You don't want to be near other people, so you're isolated from other people. But then also there's a sense like you're kind of isolated from like the way the world makes sense to other people. It's like you're not only distant from them, it's almost like there's another language that's being spoken.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I think for me, depression, and I wonder if this is the case that depression is not works in different ways for different people. Because for me, I feel like it was the thing that covered up anxiety. So there was another whole layer under it that I could, you know, so, and I couldn't get to the anxiety to process it because the depression was sort of on top, you know, like holding it all down.
Yeah, no, if you don't mind me just asking about that, because for anxiety and depression are so highly comorbid, you know, there's so much overlap. There's negative affect, there's whether it's ruminative or worrying or obsessive thoughts. There's a you know, kind of somewhere between, sometimes it's agitation. Sometimes what happens for people is that they're anxious most of the time, and then at some point they feel worn down, and then the depression happens. What you're describing is something different, though. So I just wanted to check in as to when you were saying like it was covering up the anxiety, what that meant to you.
It just, it almost felt just like a lid that was sitting on this pot. Like I could tell there was something stuff that I couldn't get to. And that wasn't always the case. I mean, so, you know, sometimes I would just like flat out, have anxiety. But the depression piece, I could always tell there was other things under it. And it just felt like it was holding it down, or a barrier to between me and it. I definitely had a lot of problems with obsessive thinking. And that's what what finally got me to try medication. I was on Lexapro, not very long, actually, like 18 months, and that sort of helped to jumpstart, be able to kind of almost program a different way of thinking, which I just could not get to. And I had this experience where I was having a thought, you know, like some, I don't know, disaster, you know, this person hates me. I can't, you know, who knows what it was. And even after there was like a point where I wasn't having it anymore, but it was still going around and around. And I was like, I don't even care about this. Like, I don't even care about this thought anymore, but I'm still having it. It was a very strange experience where you almost feel like the thought is having you, you're not even involved in the generating of the thought anymore. So that was the point at which I thought, like, I need to do something to interrupt this.
Yeah, you know, when people talk about obsessive thoughts versus worrying or even rumination, you know, you think about obsession, worrying, and rumination, which there's a lot of overlap with depression and anxiety. The thing about worrying and rumination that sometimes is a little bit comforting is that it feels like, however painful it is, you're kind of going over something in your head and you eventually come to some kind of answer.
Yeah, it feels like it's a problem.
Yeah. But the obsessiveness feels like, and it feels like you can tell the difference, not you, but someone could tell the difference. You're like, this has nothing to do with figuring out anything.
Yeah.
This just has like a life of its own in my brain.
Yeah, it really felt like a thing that was cycling in the machinery that I had maybe generated it at one point, but it was going around and around on its own, and that was just a little alarming because, you know, I think we like to feel like we're in charge of our thoughts. You know, we at least like to feel like we're having our thoughts. And that our thoughts aren't this sort of separate, you know, like a bird that's loose in a house that's just flying around.
Yeah, and it's this idea of our thoughts are having us is very interesting. I've never heard anyone put it that way, but that really strikes home. There's almost like a loss of self that happens at that moment. You know, again, the worry, the rumination, it all feels like it's like, well, this is me, but it's me kind of feeling a little bit more intense than I want to, maybe super intense, you know. Yeah. But the obsessions, it almost like, yes, like it gets you into those like kind of odd philosophical discussions. Like, am I like, just like you're saying, like, am I having my thoughts? Are my thoughts having me? What's the base here? And that's a very scary moment, because you start to question the very basic of, you know, the basics of your identity.
Yeah, that's right. Because we all feel like we are our thoughts, right? And if they become separate from us, that's very alarming. But I think depression and anxiety for me, you know, a big part of it was not having not really understanding what having a sense of self was. And, you know, I mean, I think for years I thought that what you are your thoughts, your opinions, you know, your the things you do, that there isn't sort of a sense of self that is separate from that. So, you know, that made it very anxiety producing for me to be close to somebody and have them disagree with an opinion, because I would, you know, because I sort of felt like, well, that's, you know, if all I am is just like a bundle of opinions and thoughts and, you know, books I've read and movies I've seen and these songs I like, then, you know, what does it mean if somebody disagrees with that? Then they disagree with literally a part of you. And I could not see it any other way. And I think that's sort of, I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, what narcissism is, sort of like a, you know, thinking that you're, that who you are is this bundle of outside things, right? The, you know, your habits and opinions and thoughts, and that there isn't any like real center to you.
It's interesting that you say that about narcissism, because I think most people, when they talk about it, they focus on what they see as the grandiosity, the sensitivity, what can sometimes, whether intentionally or not, be manipulation. But what you're describing, that emptiness, and oftentimes a such an intense feeling of self-loathing underlies narcissism. And it's like whether that the emptiness, the self-loathing, but there's that sense of, I can't be within myself. I've got to be these things out there somehow.
Yeah, because it does feel hollow or broken. So, and I think that's, you know, that grandiosity is like an antidote to depression or that sense of hollowness, because you're trying to fill up this negative space with, you know, it's got to be something great. You know, I mean, you have to be the greatest, you have to be the smartest, or, you know, you have to be the most important, or you have to do grand things and get awards and, you know, whatever, like whatever your version of grandiosity, or like the biggest martyr, you know, the most giving, the most caring, the most sacrificial, you know, whatever your version of it is, that I feel like is this, you know, compensation for having no sense of self.
Yeah. And one of the things that's just so tough about it is that if it worked, it wouldn't be so bad, I guess, you know, because in a like what I guess, I don't know if it was Freud called sublimation or whatever it may be, like, you know, like saying like, oh, I feel empty, let me do things that would make me feel filled up, it is kind of an adaptive response. And if doing something great that doesn't hurt anybody else is, you know, fills you up, like, good for you. And that would be wonderful if that's what happened. But the problem is that it feels as though it just never gets better. In fact, in some cases, it gets worse, because you it's almost like the greater things are, the more opportunities there are for humiliation and shame. You know, one of the things that can happen, we're talking about this cycle of narcissism, is that when you get into that sense, and this is not just narcissism, this is with depression, this is with anxiety, the pain can be so great that suicide becomes a thought that people have. It becomes a possibility. It becomes this idea of, well, what are the ways that I can escape this? You know, it's like you said before, like, well, oh, you said exercise was going to help the depression, but it's not. You said if I did this kind of therapy, it was going to help, but maybe it's not. I thought if I make myself really, like, you know, famous or whatever, that's not helping. And sometimes that thought comes in, and this idea for, you know, for one of your songs, suicide is murder. is that's a, you know, obviously like that's a powerful statement. And I want to kind of just talk with you about that perspective. Cause my understanding was it was a lot of having to do with how it would feel if someone who was close to you killed themselves.
Well, let me tell you how I came to write this song. So I was asked to write music for a stage production of Girl Interrupted, the book, not from the movie, but from the book. And so the writer has a whole passage where she talks about suicide because she had made a suicide attempt. And so the writer's sort of attitude is, in the book is very much like, I'm going to be a reporter and just kind of dispassionately discuss what being institutionalized was like and report on the people that I met. And so that sort of reporter attitude, I think, is in this passage. And she's talking about how you have to, you know, because suicide is an inherently horrible idea, you have to accustom yourself to the idea of doing it, get used to the idea of doing it and try to detach from the idea of seeing yourself dead or hurting yourself. And so she likens it to murder in that respect, that it's, you know, which I think is a way to remind you that it's horrible. And so I was writing the song, taking that as a starting point. But, you know, as I went along, because I've known people who've killed themselves. I have friends who have had loved ones kill themselves. And it's just so devastating. It is so, the aftermath for people left behind is so awful and so devastating. And I think there's no one even as a casual friend left behind or acquaintance left behind who won't feel guilty and responsible on some level. Like it's really sort of a torturous thing that spreads to everybody. And so that's why sort of as you get to the bridge of the song, you know, the narrator switches from this voice of almost advice giving to just keep in mind how this is going to ruin everybody's life. And sort of takes it more seriously and, you know, brings some more feeling into it. So that's the kind of evolution of that song.
Yeah. And it's such a difficult topic because, you know, as a psychologist, when I work with people, I have to be able to understand and empathize with the feelings that would lead someone to want to harm themselves. And yet at the same time, try to say, but look at what would happen, you know, like, because oftentimes one of the thoughts that people have is like, well, the world would be better off without me.
Yeah.
You know, and you want to balance that, but sometimes it's, I'm just in so much pain. And then talking about, well, this is what would happen if you do that. Unfortunately, even, it kind of makes the pain even worse. And so it's such a tricky balance to know, like, what's going to feel supportive at that moment? Because, you know, like the idea that the people who you left behind would miss you and would be harmed, like in theory, that's a very supportive concept. You're like, oh man, I didn't realize I was as needed as that. But then if it misses in terms of how it gets, you know, kind of conveyed, it's like, oh, okay, now I'm like that self-loathing, that shame. It's like, now I'm even worse than I thought I was. Cause now I'm not only harming me, I'm harming all these other people. Oh my God. Like, you know, right. It's so hard to balance.
Well, I think because that level of depression is so profoundly disconnected, you know, I remember being in a period of real isolation and depression, and you know, what this is, I put this in the song, is the idea of make a list of people who would care if, you know, if you were gone. And I couldn't come up with anybody. And I think that's because I felt so disconnected from them. I couldn't imagine that they felt connected to me, you know, and it wasn't like a self-pity thing. I just like actually couldn't, I was like, well, that might bother them a little bit, but like not, like you just don't, you're just disconnected. You can't imagine that anyone would care that much. There's another point I was going to make. So the other thing in my experience, this is a very weird thing. So this last year, which was just delightful for everybody, right? I developed this neurological condition that made me really sick. And I was dizzy all the time and I felt nauseous all the time. And I was really, it's kind of like eventually diagnosed in the general sort of migraine category, like vestibular migraine, which just means we don't know. But I was really sick all the time and felt like I had a concussion. So I was really sensitive to light. So I couldn't use my phone. I couldn't go in the computer. I couldn't watch TV. I was really sensitive to sound. I had stopped listening to music. So all of this last year during the pandemic, I could literally do nothing. And one of the medications that they try was antidepressant, like an early version of the antidepressant, and it made me psychotic. So I had this episode where I was suicidal, yes, but it was almost like a rageful homicidal feeling, but against myself. And that I can't explain it any more than that. And I actually like at one point sort of screamed, I'd fucking kill myself, but it's just another goddamn job I'd have to do. So it like the idea was I couldn't do anything because I felt so sick. And feel like that would solve the problem, that's an appropriate reaction to the problem. And, fortunately after like a few days of this, I thought, you know, maybe I should read the literature that comes with this medication. like maybe it's a side effect. And so it was. So like I immediately went off of it and that went away. But, it was just an interesting, it was just like I was homicidally furious, but like I was the person that I was directing it at.
I'm sorry that you went through that. It's so scary and so difficult, you know, because when you add depression and then what effectively is kind of a reaction to medication, like a delirium or a psychotic reaction.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about feeling out of control, you know?
Yeah. And it's not like I didn't feel like that, but it definitely magnified it, by a thousandfold. Because I was pretty despairing. I mean, I thought like, well, I obviously will never work again. And I don't even know, I couldn't do anything. So I couldn't, I couldn't like distract myself or, try to have fun it was just like, talk about rumination. I mean, it's, all you're thinking about is how sick you are, which obviously makes it worse.
Yeah. And, something you said before about, I don't know how you phrased it, but that nobody would care. It's interesting because, for a couple of reasons, one is, you have all of these fans, who obviously would care. And some of the music that you've written is, or that you've performed is to some extent what other people, use during those times. So for example, like I didn't know that up until I researched this interview that you and Michael Penn were married, but I've been listening to Two of Us, your version of Two of Us from I Am Sam for years. And quite frankly, that's one of my feel good songs. Like that's just a song that wherever I'm at, I'm just kind of like, oh. And then when I found out you guys were married, it was sort of like, oh my God, like you could feel that energy in the song. So I guess I'm kind of curious because it's probably very odd for somebody who's been a fan or admired your work when you're the one who can make us feel a little bit better during those times, but somehow that doesn't help you. Like I'm assuming you didn't put on Two of Us and all of a sudden be like, oh yeah, I feel better.
Well, you know, I think if I could have listened to music, it would have helped. And if I could have made music, you know, if I could have, but I was having, part of my symptoms were that hearing distortion, like literal sounds would be literally distorted. So I couldn't do it. I mean, it was too awful, you know, and it also was unpleasant. Like listening to music was very unpleasant. And I'm, you know, still haven't really gotten out of that. And it was scary. I think music had, that was part of the despair. Like music has been a thing that is very healing. And, you know, even on a level of, it's fun and interesting to translate your present state or your problems or whatever into music or into a story or, you know, a story about somebody else maybe, but like to have that alchemy of transferring feelings into, you know, into this sonic landscape and, you know, like, or, you know, with, you know, some lyrical, you know, some kind of story or words or, you know, to have that sort of magic happen is, it's very healing. So to not have that was really tough. Like, I mean, I just didn't have anything.
Hey, do you mind if I ask just, do you have a regimen that works for you in terms of just your ongoing mental health care? Like, is it, you know, I hear it sounds like there's stuff that's happening right now that you're still struggling with, but is there anything that you found consistently works for you with either depression or anxiety or this issue that you're facing now?
Well, a lot of different things through the years. I actually started going after I started taking Lexapro, I started to go to Al-Anon, which, you know, is kind of like a cognitive behavioral therapy practice. And, you know, also I find it very useful to have friends, to have people, not even necessarily friends, but like to have people that you can call and talk to. And then it really, you know, first of all, like to have other people say, oh, I understand, I've gone through this, here's what's worked for me. Nobody gives you advice, you know, which is great. But people will say like, well, this worked for me when I tried it, you know, and then you try it. But that also helps to just interrupt, you know, the thought process that are leading to the feelings. So that's been a thing I've done for years, and that's really helped. But, you know, what I found interesting, really fascinating about this neurological situation I was in, I can't believe that this is how it happened, but I got an ad for an app, and the app is called Curable, and it's for people with chronic pain, which I wasn't really sure if I fit that criteria, but I started doing research, and you know, the app is just like, oh, you know, once again, like super directed cognitive behavioral therapy exercises. And you know, I started doing research about chronic pain and migraines and you know, sort of discovered that there's this real link between stress and past trauma and the nervous system becoming very reactive. And when it becomes very reactive, it produces pain signals, which can be, you know, dizziness and gastrointestinal symptoms and tinnitus and, you know, inflammation, you know, I mean, like a lot of different things. And so I started doing these exercises and it's like 99% better. And it's really connected with, you know, there's like an emotional connection, but what was interesting to me is like, I didn't feel anxious, but I was, you know, when this all happened, like I wasn't feeling anxious, but I was starting to feel really isolated because, you know, we're in a pandemic and we were isolated. But I think because I felt like that shouldn't have been a problem, I didn't process it. And so, you know, I think feeling isolated for me is, and I think most humans, like, you know, the jury is in on how social isolation can really impact people cognitively. You know, I think your chance of dementia goes up like 50% or something if you're super socially isolated. But, you know, but I didn't really have, you know, it wasn't conscious. It was just this like ongoing background noise of, you know, a fear. Because it makes you, you know, I just like as a human animal, I think it makes you feel afraid to not have your herd around you.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I think people have a lot of trouble processing is the idea that the feeling that you have, so for example, anxiety, is not necessarily related to the stressor that you have or the nature of the stressor.
Yeah.
And all these things that we're talking about, they cause stress. You know, so for example, one thing that we'll often do in studies of stress is we'll just say, well, transitions. You know, have you gotten a new job or did you move or did you, you know, are you going to school? And these could all be wonderful things. You know, you could have gotten into the college of your choice or be moving in with someone who's a romantic relationship or got this great new job, but transitions are stressful. And therefore when people are saying, well, why am I nervous? Why am I having headaches? I don't get it. And, you know, it's that's something that's very tough for people to say, because like, what am I so nervous about, as though the anxiety is connected with something like sort of meaningfully that's part of the stress. And that may not be the case. Just the stress keeps adding up.
Yeah.
And then at some point you just kind of pop.
That's absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think for me, you know, never underestimate like the silent power of the, you know, I shouldn't feel this way. I think especially in this country, we really have, you know, an idea about the rugged individualism is like the holy grail, and that we should all strive to be, you know, like going into the woods with like a rifle and a bag of rice and, you know, living on our own without other people, and which is what the Into the Wild guy did. It's, you know, it's delusional. Like people don't live like that. We're, you know, you don't function optimally like that. And, you know, I think for me, it's exacerbated because my husband really likes to spend a lot of time alone. And you know, so I would look at him and go like, well, he's fine. So obviously that's not it, you know. Meanwhile, like, you know, like literally can't function. I'm dizzy all the time and can't sleep and, you know, can only sleep sitting up, which, by the way, is not possible. And, you know, just all these crazy symptoms.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's so tough about that, and this is, you know, something that I think people, you know, one of the quotes that I really like that you made, I think it was about this album, was you said it's hard to be a person.
Yeah.
Was a term which I think it captures like the whole thing, quite frankly. And one of the things that's really tough is that, and you know, as you're a musician, it's like the single-mindedness that it takes to be a successful musician, the ability to push everything away, the ability to, you know, I'm sure at some point, you know, just playing show after show after show, not sleeping, not eating healthy, like even if you were sick, like, you know, like those are all the things that I'm sure you've gone through. And so there's this sense of like, well, I had to do that in order to be successful. But when it comes to emotional stuff, I think the thing that people don't realize is that it's not that it's not admirable, I guess, to try, you know, it's, I guess it's nice if you want to push aside your anxiety to perform or to go about your life. I mean, it's an admirable impulse. It just doesn't work is the problem. And that's when people say like a rugged individualism, it's like, if you're a rugged individual, like you want to know what works. And that's the thing that I, you know, kind of hoping people pick up on more is that being mindful and aware of what you're feeling is not contradicting being rugged. In fact, it's part of it. If you want to have more long, if you want to have more long-term ruggedness, because as time goes on, it's something's going to just give, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm not exactly a person who's not in touch with their feelings, you know, like I am not coming from, you know, I mean, I'm perfectly happy to examine my feelings, but, you know, but I think in this case, I just underestimated the impact that isolation would have on me. I mean, I think everybody did that because nobody really talks about isolation. I mean, this is a unique case, but social isolation is just not sort of commonly discussed as a stressor. Like for old people, which, you know, I mean, I guess I qualify, but like, you know, I mean, you think about like, you know, grandma in the nursing home, you know, like you don't think it's going to be you. But I think it's happening to a lot of people. I think the pandemic was a real slow motion, invisible trauma, and people are traumatized.
No, I think you're right. You know, it's kind of like in some ways it's similar to money. It's like everything about your life, it gives a little bit of a different shine if you have money and it like, okay, I made some right decisions because I have money. And it's similar, like if you have people in your life, you start thinking, oh, you know, well, I must have made the right decision here because I'm married or because I have friends or because, you know, I have coworker, whatever it is. And without that or without that connection, you start to kind of ask yourself, it's sort of like what we were talking about with the obsessive thinking, like you start just questioning fundamentally, well, who am I if I'm not connected to people? Yeah. What am I feeling so great about myself for if like that hasn't led to, you know, certain connections being strong? And once you start going down that road, I mean, it spirals because by definition, it's like if you're socially isolated, well, who are you going to reach out to to not be isolated?
Yeah. And then when you're, you know, now it's an emergency and like, oh, you're going to call that person you haven't talked to in a month and tell them that you're losing your mind and, you know, no, you can stay right where you are in your house alone.
Well, and that's the power of the anonymous programs. I think, you know, you said it's kind of similar to cognitive behavioral therapy, but, you know, and you actually said something that's really, really interesting is you sort of questioned, is the best person to reach out to always a friend? And sometimes it's not. Sometimes having like a support group where the people are not your conventional friends is better for that very reason, you know, because it's like, you know, the last thing you want oftentimes is for everything that you're going through to be kind of out on the street, you know, if you will, like, you know, everybody to know that, like you kind of want to keep, but you kind of have to tell that story for people to understand you. And so it's, you know, you don't know that all your friends or any of your friends are going to be able to take that. I mean, that's kind of where we started the discussion. Yeah. You know, and having something like an anonymous program or support group where there's people who've been through it, it matters a lot. Just knowing it's like, oh, okay, like I'm not sort of just out there in the middle of nowhere. There's other people who feel like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, once again, just to stress like that unsolicited advice is so unhelpful, because you can tell that the other person is usually invested in it. And the thing I love about Al-Anon is people are like, here's the principles of Al-Anon that I have applied to my life in the following ways. You know, you can take it or leave it. And nobody's invested. And that makes such a huge difference.
No, absolutely. And getting back to it's hard, you know, it's hard to be a person. It's hard. It's almost, again, where we began this discussion. It's hard to know, like when you're sitting there and you're like, I have something that I think would work. And like, you know, but that middle ground of just being like, hey, listen, I don't know. Let me acknowledge, like, I can't 100% know what's going to work for you. Let me just offer, you know, let me even ask, like, hey, do you want me to offer something up? Just like knowing that, like, hey, I see that you're there as an independent person. Just because you have a mental health issue doesn't mean that like all your boundaries are now shattered and I'm just going to like come like charging in there with my advice can make the difference for someone.
Yeah, completely. And it really does help to talk to people who have been in your, you know, exact position.
Well, and you know, if I may segue, because I think unfortunately we have to stop, but you know, somebody like yourself stepping up also, I mean, that's, you know, quite frankly, that's the point of the podcast, is so that maybe there are people who don't have access to support groups, or maybe there are people who don't have therapists or friends that they feel like they can count on, but at least they can hear that there's somebody who, you know, whose music they've known, they've admired. It's like, oh, okay, there is somebody out there. And I appreciate it, because you don't, you know, you've already had a wonderfully successful career. You don't have to step up and do this. And so I appreciate, you know, you being willing to talk about this stuff in such detail, because, I know it's going to help people.
Yeah, completely my pleasure. I think this stuff is interesting, and I think just having an attitude of curiosity about it has also helped me get out of it. Like it helps to be an objective observer of, you know, your own brain.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I wish you the best luck with the new album and your career. And I hope everything works out as best as possible with this neurological issue that you're facing.
I'm much better. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So there it is, Amy Mann talking about her struggle with depression and anxiety, and how difficult it is when there is someone close to us who's also struggling with their mental health. There's so much to take away from the conversation with Amy. One of the things that Amy discussed that was so powerful was how at her lowest moment, she felt that nobody cared. And that is the horrible power of anxiety and depression, because when we are overwhelmed with intense negative emotion, it is often so hard for us to take in or believe anything that isn't consistent with that negative feeling. As Amy described, we feel isolated, alone, often hopeless, and we can't imagine that anyone would feel connected to us. But for anyone out there who is feeling this way, even if you don't believe that anyone cares and don't feel that you are connected to anyone, just try and reach out in some way to someone to get help. This can be a friend, coworker, family member, mental health professional, support group, or helpline. And if we have people who we are concerned about regarding their mental health, and there's a chance they may not feel like anyone is connected to them, a check-in or a call can sometimes make a huge difference, often much more than we realize. I want to thank Consequence Podcast Network and Sound Mind Live for including me in this wonderful project. And thanks to Pete Wilson and the Rooks for letting us use their song, I Know. If you are struggling with anxiety, depression, or addiction and are looking for help, please call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration National Helpline at 1-800-622-4357. And if you're thinking about harming yourself and you want to seek help,
please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. You may also go to Sound Mind Live and Consequence websites for more information. So be healthy, be safe, and be kind to yourself and others. See you next time at the Crossroads.